introductory remarks stage of this lesson. This is where we are talking about this. Money is not really about money. Problems with money are rarely money problems. Most of the time, money problems are problems of the heart. And so, founded on that premise, we're doing a lesson about money that isn't about money management. It's not about budgeting. It's not about estate planning. It's not a Christian financial seminar. Jesus had a great deal to say about money, but he had very little to say about money management. For Jesus, money was a way to find the condition of the human heart. And money, as it turns out, is a portal into that condition. It helps us see what goes on within our souls. Now, I made my apologies last week for a case of unfortunate timing. I sent the community an email saying that the next four generosity chats, which we do at the end of each lesson, I'll be asking you for money to hire a teen ministry coordinator, an intern to do that. I'm doing that at the same time I'm doing a lesson on the spirituality of money, and given the shady manipulation that has gone on so many times in church through the years, any minister with a lick of sense knows better. So what in the world am I doing this? However, knowing with eyes wide open to the underhanded ways the church has handled money, knowing that this topic requires special sensitivity, I'm nevertheless going ahead and doing these two things at the same time, because every night that I watch the news, I am more convinced we need to talk about the crazy-making power of money. Every night that I listen to what's going on in our national life, what's affecting our souls, I'm more and more convinced that we need to be thinking about the condition of our hearts. And at the same time, both Richard and Tim have talked to me independently, telling me that they've needed a break with our middle school and with our teen ministry, and that highlighted a need that we've had for a long time, and we really do need to be caring for our teens. So, again, as I said, keep up whatever guard you need to keep up to make sure that you are not manipulated, but do try and use these weeks for thinking about the condition of your soul, about how your money habits reveal something about your core beliefs. So, that being said, let's begin. Recently, I heard, I think Nicole was one who told me about it, about this way of fostering health by working on intestinal health. Now, I crossed the 50-year barrier, and when you do that, you start thinking not about how many years you have, but how many years you have left. And so I start thinking in terms of, is this body going to take me as far as I need this body to take me? So she talked to me about this book, the premise of which is that all health begins with intestinal health, and so here's what you got to do to take care of your digestive tract. And so I did this thing. And when I did it, it's called the cleaning program or something, I combined it with some of the ancient spiritual practices of fasting. And I put the two of them together. It was not a complete fast, but it was a partial fast. Fasting tends to highlight the false self instincts at a time when, theoretically, our hearts and our minds are clear enough to see them. Because after the first few days of a fast, the misery of hunger tends to subside. We're weaker, we've got less strength, but it doesn't hurt. And because we're weaker, our natural defenses against our false self strategies are also weakened. And inevitably, something that has always been a part of us will come out. You will experience bitterness toward the long-term offense from someone that you know. Or you will feel a deep sense of frustration about how circumstances are slowing down your efforts when you want to keep moving forward. Or you'll feel short toward other people, toward loved ones, toward coworkers. And at that time, the theory goes, our minds will be clear enough, because fasting does tend to clear our minds, to be able to focus enough to be able to see these things for what they are. To stand outside of those false self instincts, to observe them. Look at me being bitter toward my sister-in-law. You know, I don't think I've ever forgiven her for this thing or that thing from so long ago. Or, look at me being frustrated with interruptions and inefficiencies. I wonder what it is about me that feels like I should not be slowed down. What makes me think that the universe should line up for me? What makes me equate rightness with smooth sailing? Maybe I should learn the path of peace or of patience. And we might, during this time of fasting, pray, Spirit of God, awaken within me the divine peace and the divine patience that indwells, for the Spirit of God indwells. So that's the kind of thing that happens when you go on one of these fasts. And in the one that I just finished, some things came up inside of me. About the fifth or the sixth day, I had a toxic case of boredom. And I did not have the physical energy to work as hard as I usually work. I have folders and folders of interesting things that I usually work on. I have things that I can work on to be strengthening our community. I have things that I can be mulling over and jotting down to write about, things that I could be thinking about for lessons that are upcoming, podcasts to listen to, books to be reading. But with less food, my body was tired and my head was tired. Now, it would have been a very appropriate time to just slow down. It would have been an appropriate time to just quiet myself and to live my days more simply, to be more attentive to the Spirit of God within me, to live without a driving agenda, without interesting thoughts to think, to live without interesting activities to be involved in. And that's what I did for a minute. Until all of a sudden, a desire captured my heart, and it was the desire to buy something. My days are mobile. I go from place to place, and I cart around this great big briefcase wherever I go. Feel sorry for me. And I thought to myself how convenient it would be. This thought just exploded into my mind, you know. A netbook would make my life so much more convenient. I've had that thought many times over the course of the last year or so, and each time I weighed the benefits and the cost, and I never thought it was quite worth it, but this time, this thought would not be quieted. You need a netbook. And my heart churned over the details of how good it would be if I had a netbook. I salivated over the small size, how it's not much bigger than a pocketbook, and how it's got 7 hours of battery life, so I wouldn't have to carry a power cord, and how it had everything packed on it that I need, and now I would be much more efficient, and I would get so many more things done with my shiny new netbook. You need a netbook, my brain was telling me. And so, truth to be told, Doug, my brain is telling me, you've been foolish for not getting it already. So you know what? It's time for you to do some research, because you need just the right netbook. You need the one with the full-size keyboard, and you got to have Windows 7 so that it's more stable, and you want to make sure that it has all the features that you use, because you don't want to be stuck in a Panera somewhere and not have the feature that you need, and so you want to make sure that you get the best possible price. Yes, my brain kept telling me, Doug, you need a netbook. And to help me make my decision, my brain gave me all kinds of imagined fantasies. Fantasies of how smooth my days would run with my new netbook. Fantasies about all the hassles that had previously plagued my daily life and how they would all go away and evaporate, how my days would be so much nicer. And look, my brain said, how the stars have aligned. It just so happens that your appointment later today is right next door to Best Buy. And look, it's almost as if God intended it. You have 45 minutes from the end of that appointment until your next appointment. You should go into Best Buy. Just look. And the air was so cool inside of Best Buy, and it was a hot, hot day. And the floors were so shiny, and the displays were all dancing with energy, but the music was so calming and relaxing, and everything was just so darn engaging. And after my brain had drugged me through Best Buy and I was on my way about back out to the car, my thoughts were all a swirl, and I couldn't wait to hurry through this next appointment and get it over with so that I could get to Sam's and BJ's and see what kind of deals they had on my new netbook. And my brain and my heart had mustered a heroic strategy not to get me a netbook. My brain and my heart had mustered a heroic strategy to distract me. And they had done all of this work of distraction on half rations. I was starving them, and they still were able to get me distracted. As God, as our witness, my brain and heart said, this man's heart will not live simply. As God is our witness, you can starve us if you want, but we will find an agenda that will drive your mind and drive your thoughts. We will find a way around that fear of boredom. We will try find a way to focus on your fear of quiet, and we will resist simplicity in your life, and we will find interesting thoughts for you to think. And know this, we will not be shushed. As God is our witness, we will not be shushed. Now, was the experience about a netbook? Not really. Sort of, a little bit, but not much. Most of the times that you get a buying Jones, it's really not about the thing, not really. Self, we might say to ourselves, you really don't need those new flats, but boy, are they perfect for this outfit. Self, we might say to ourselves, you really don't need that jacket, but boy, it sure is right, isn't it? That other part of us will reply. That carrying bag has a place for everything that you need in it. How cool that new widget will be. How fine that thing. And by the way, it will save you money because it's on sale. And all of these thoughts come to us and they ask us to give our time and to give our attention and to give our earning dollars and giving our earning hours to this great big soul distraction. Now we can talk reason to this part of ourself. We can say to this part of ourself, don't do this thing, it's not that important. We can weigh the cost and the benefit, and we can do all those kinds of things. But when one of these false self strategies kicks in, it has a strong will and a strong agenda. And usually it's not an explicit agenda, it's usually a tacit one. And often, very often, one might even say most often, these false self strategies have something to do with money. Now, here's how this false self-strategy worked out for me. Somewhere along the way, looking out at life and thinking it's a scary place, some young version of Doug looked up and realized, you know, I need an identity that's going to help me navigate the world, and so here's one that I chose. I chose the I'm the do-good-stuff guy. I'm the work-harder-than-everybody-else guy. I'm the get-stuff-done guy. And that became the script by which I have lived my life. And any deviation from that script creates all kinds of unconscious internal angst. So while quiet may be good for the soul, and setting aside seasons for not doing something may be good for the soul, they don't match the script. And so when they deviate from the script, there's a price that must be paid. Stepping back from the get stuff done, Doug, is healthy, but as good as it is for me, it doesn't match how I have determined my life will find value. So what I have to do is muster a little more oomph to the script, and so I add nobility into it. And for me, the nobility goes something like this. I am a minister, and as a minister, I am helping people. And so that requires that I study hard so that I can help people well. And that requires that I think deeply and think broadly and put in lots of hours, that I work hard, that I read lots of interesting things. But that's why I'm working so hard, because I'm a noble man. And every so often, part of me recognizes this sham for what it is. And every so often, part of me recognizes that that's just another version of the false self-strategy tacked on to make sure I can follow the script and validate my worth, make sure that I'm not wasting the breath that I breathe on this planet. And so I put a nice spin on an unhealthy practice, and it makes me feel good about me. And every once in a while, though, I see what I'm doing, and I say, ah, it's time for a fast. Or, ah, it's time to go down to the monastery and stay there for 4 days where you have to be silent. There's nothing else to do. What surprised me this time is that even when I challenged the script by starving it, my false self has a fantastic backup plan. You need to buy something, Doug. Not something silly, no, that would not match the nobility that you've associated with your script. Instead, you need to buy something that will make you more efficient, something that will make you better at working hard. Then, when the fast is finished, after we have finished this time aside that we've set aside for God, then that's the time when you can be back to working hard. Now, I'm telling you this now with a great deal of interior understanding. I understand what happened to me over the course of this last month. I didn't very well understand it at the time. At the time, it just felt like this strong impulse. And at the time, I didn't really know what I was doing. But now I have an opportunity for a post-mortem analysis. Now I get a chance to look and prayerfully change over time. And I tell this about myself, betting that I am not the only one in the room that has ever had an experience like this. In fact, I know you, and I've heard some of your stories, and I know that it happens to you as well. We find ourselves sometimes finding within ourselves this erupted obsession about something. Something that we just have to have, something that we discover with frightening urgency that we must possess. Now, it's true that we need things in life, and you cannot cut off things from your life because we live in bodies and bodies have needs. So we need food and we need the things necessary to cook food. We need shelter. We need chairs to sit in. We need tables to sit at. We need computers to communicate. We need the things that to help us do our work, and we need access to a doctor, and we need to be able to buy medicine from time to time. There are essential parts of human life that are associated with things, with stuff, and the money that is required to buy those things. But many, many times in our lives, we find ourselves acting under a strange compulsion that has nothing to do with the essentials of life. In the 1600s, this happened in Holland over tulips. There was a craze that just led people into all kinds of frenzy, mortgaging their lives, mortgaging their businesses, mortgaging their homes in order to buy these special tulip bulbs. In the 1800s, we saw this kind of stuff-driven obsession in California around this craziness around gold rocks. And people uprooted their lives and changed their whole understanding of what it meant to be in a community. They shifted the demographics of our nation. They did all kinds of things because there was a craze, an obsession with gold rocks. In the 1980s, living in LA as I did, the teenagers, many of them had this huge obsession over Nike Air tennis shoes. And then you see the obsessions over Tickle Me Elmo dolls or pet rocks or Beanie Babies. Or I was just talking to one of the guys in our church about his kid's obsession with Pokemon cards. And so with regularity, our relationship to things shifts from being one of acquiring life's essentials to an obsession over something that is in fact not an essential. It doesn't matter what the object is. It could be an iPad or it could be a new boyfriend. You're bumping along in life when all of a sudden you see something and you have to have it. A moment before you didn't even know you needed it, but now it has captured your mind, it has captured your thoughts, it has captured your heart. You have to have it, and sooner would be better. And almost always that something costs money. And a condition of the heart, which is obsession, gets translated into a condition of the wallet, which has to do with money. And so we begin to see that in many ways, here's one more way in which money problems are in fact heart problems. And obsessions, when they come to us, tend to have lives of their own. They swirl around us with so much power that they are able to live just that, this life of their own that drives us and compels us, defines how we spend our moments on the earth, determines how we spend our monies, determines where our energies go to getting the money that we need to service our obsessions. And the imperative comes to us: buy this thing, possess this thing, get this thing. And when it takes over, it's like tunnel vision comes in and we can think of nothing else. Now, if you are a perfect statistical sampling of our national life, then you are awakening from a spending hangover. For more than a decade, we had a stock market, and we had monetary policy, and we had a housing bubble that gave us a tremendous amount of freedom to service our obsessions. We had easy credit. We had low unemployment. We had quick equity in our homes, and we had easy access to that equity. And if you had to run up your credit card in order to service your obsession, no problem, run up your credit card. And if you had to borrow against the house in order to service your obsession, no problem, borrow against the house, service the obsession. But in the last 36 months or so, circumstances have changed. And we have much tighter credit than we had. We keep hearing about shaky economic indicators. The threat of foreclosures is all around us. Jobs are harder to come by. Circumstances have limited our ability to service our obsessions. But the question for us as spiritual people is, are we getting out of this economic downturn what we could get about out of it? I had this professor in graduate school, he had this saying, he would say, the point of pain, boys, is not to get out of pain. The point of pain is to get out of pain what you need to get out of pain. And the question is, are we getting out of this economic downturn what we need to get out of this economic downturn? Or are we just biding our time until things go back to normal, waiting until we can freely once again service our obsessions? If you listen to the news, it's pretty clear which way we're going. There is an undercurrent of longing in the news for the good old days. The pundits are talking about getting consumer confidence back, because once the consumer feels free to service his or her obsession for the new handbag or for the new shoes or for the new mower or for the new house or for the new sports car, then we'll know that the good times are rolling once again when consumer confidence comes back. So a friend of mine asked me this week about this ancient discipline of fasting. And so for a while, we talked about the physical side of things. We talked about how our bodies respond. We talked about how sometimes we have this, well, did I talk to you about that Science Friday, or is that the last lesson? Well, I heard this episode of Science Friday in which they gave these rats a lot of probiotics, of this one particular strain of probiotics. And in the process of doing it, they found that their anxiety level dropped tremendously. And then the guy talked about this great big packet of neural connections that we have. It's like a second brain that we have associated with our digestive tract. And so consequently, intestinal health translates into mental health. You end up reducing your anxiety when you take care of gut health. And so then there's this big nerve that goes from the gut to the brain, and they cut that nerve, and lo and behold, the benefits didn't accrue to them. So there is a connection between, it's like we have an ancillary brain somewhere in our gut. So when you talk about a gut feeling, there's something to that. When you talk about feeling it in your gut or having a sense of these things, there is a brain part of us there. Well, the physical dimensions of fasting begin to create health here. Ends up that, lo and behold, has mental benefits, has emotional benefits. It helps us. And so we do this thing. And so we talked about the health dimensions for a while. But then I said, throughout history, what we spiritual people have done is add on top of the health benefits that come from fasting. In each one of the traditions, there is also a set of spiritual disciplines that have been associated with the fast. And one of those disciplines is to allow the inevitable irritations that come when we fast, the inevitable fears that we feel when we fast, the inevitable frustrations, to allow those fears and irritations and frustrations to alert us to the true condition of our soul. There's an old expression that says, who you are under stress is who you are. And fasting helps diagnose who you are by removing this subsidized reality that keeps it hidden. I reminded her of a phrase that we use all the time. Afflictive emotions are your friend, because afflictive emotions reveal that a strategy of the false self has been crossed. And then I said, so if it's true that afflictive emotions are your friends, then fasting is like inviting your friends over for dinner. It's like saying, come on over, we're gonna get together. When people fast, they do have these afflictive emotions that come up, and in that, it is revealed to them what goes on in their souls at the core. So Now, this has been part of my spiritual tradition since I was a kid. It's been part of my practice, and I've figured out a lot of ways to handle fasting. Here's one way to handle fasting. While you're fasting and you get hungry, you think about what you'd like to eat. And then if you've thought about that for a while, you think about how you would cook that thing that you'd like to eat, or where you would go to buy it. Or you realize, you know, when I finish, I'm only going to get one meal before I'm full. What would be the exact right meal that I would want? What would I put in that meal? Where would I go? What are my favorites? What are the things that I would like? And you can spend a whole fast just thinking those kinds of things. I know, I've done it. But at the end of that, you finish your meal, and all you were for that fast was hungry. The other alternative when you fast is to allow what the ancients have taught us, is to allow the afflictive emotions to instill in us prayers of desire. Holy Spirit, I find myself being impatient. Process within me the patience that is born of the divine center. I find myself being ungracious, unforgiving. I find myself being irritated. I find myself being rushed. I find myself being driven. Holy Spirit, I lay these before you. And you can do that during a fast as well. Well, in a way, our economic downturn is like a fast. We didn't choose this one, but it is upon us. We are going without something we want. We can no longer service our obsessions the way that we did. And like a fast, we can approach this thing with one of those two ways. We can either think about the things we want. We can fantasize about the day when the market comes back and our IRAs will grow so much faster than they're growing. We can daydream about the widgets that we can buy and how we're going to get them when we can. We're going to visualize the object of our obsession, and we can dream of the day when we can get it. Or we could become observers of our obsessions. We could recognize the ulterior motives of the false self. We could see our obsessions as a form of spiritual ADD. Focus on the soul, okay. Oh, but wait a minute, look over here at this shiny new bauble. Focus on the soul, oh, wait a minute, worry in the night about this thing. Focus on the soul, or we could see these desires as distractions from looking at the state of our soul. But instead of indulging our distractions, instead of pandering to our tendency to divert ourselves, we could be looking at what the obsession is telling us about us. Why am I distracting myself? What am I distracting myself from? What does my agitation and my desire, what does my obsession tell me that I should not be looking at, that I should be distracted from? And we could use this enforced economic fast to invite us to pray. Holy Spirit, I don't even know what my obsessions are trying to distract me from, but I want to be the truest manifestation of my divine center self. I want to be awakened from my deadened state. Alert me to that from which I have distracted myself. Help me to not simply react to the impulses within me. Help me to live from a place of settled peace. Help me to live in a way that I do not need to be distracted, that I might live from a centered self that is content in its being. Help me see my obsessions as obsessions. And in that awareness, help me to see how that behavior is being driven, how my practices are being driven, my priorities are being driven, my life is being driven by something that is not worthy. Now, to put a little context around this, I want to take you back to a lesson from a long time ago, a reminder, and you remember the phrase that I used is cheeseburger thought, cheeseburger bought. And here was the concept. The concept was that we and our impulses are in an undistinguishable oneness. As soon as I have the impulse, I define myself as the impulse. As soon as I am hungry for a cheeseburger, I go get a cheeseburger. As soon as I have a desire, I am that desire. And what I said over time is that with spiritual training, with the spiritual practices that we have been focused on, we can put a gap between the stimulus and the response. It is not to say that we won't have the obsessions, it's just that we can stand outside the obsession and observe it. And we can say to ourselves, oh, look at me obsessing over a new pair of shoes. Oh, look at me obsessing over my desire for a new car. Oh, look at me over there doing that thing, and I remove myself from being the impulse. I am not the impulse. I have the impulse, but the truer part of me is able to observe the impulse. And that's what we do when we take seasons like this economic downturn and we turn them into spiritual practices. I have the obsession, and now I stand outside of the obsession and I observe the obsession. And as soon as I can observe it, I begin to define it as not me. It is something that I feel, it is something that I am processing, it is something I am making decisions about, but it is not me. I am not immersed in that desire, in that want, in that thought. And so, if I can do that, then it's not long from there of observing the obsession before I can begin to make decisions about the obsession. I can either service it, or I can decide to not service it. When I am the obsession, I don't have that decision-making capacity. I just am it, and I get it. Cheeseburger thought, cheeseburger bought. But when I can stand outside of it, then I can make an informed decision. Will I service this obsession, or will I not service this obsession? And when we begin to do that, we begin to move forward in the spiritual journey. All right, now we get to the place where you're going to need that sticky note. So grab your sticky note and grab something to write with, because you're going to make yourself a reminder. We are now in the introductory part of this lesson. We are going to talk later about what to do, but right now we're just taking an inventory. I want you to write yourself a reminder, and don't write it yet because I want to give you the full context and then you put it in your own words. Here's the reminder I want you to give yourself. Over the next week or two, I want you to remind yourself to be asking these questions. What are my obsessions? When does a buying Jones kick in with me? When does it come up? What time of day does it come up? What kind of season of my life does it tend to infect? What are the kinds of things that come up when an obsession comes up? And then I want you to think back over the summer. What was it like this last few weeks, this last many weeks? And start thinking about now as we move into the fall. And make a reminder to become an observer of yourself. What are my money obsessions? Do mine tend to be obsessions over widgets or for shoes or a handbag or a gadget or some kind of a lifestyle marker that says I've attained this or that? Are mine obsessions about a security? Am I concerned about the savings account? And am I concerned about the retirement account? Am I concerned about the stock return? Take an inventory. What is it that comes up and grips me? What is it that has control over me? What is it that consumes my thoughts in the night hours? And then, once you get this on your sticky note and you put that in words, then you take that and you put it on your bathroom mirror, you put it on your dashboard in the car, put it somewhere where you're going to have time to be thinking about it over the weeks to come. Because if you are thinking about it, then the next time you're meeting with one of your spiritual friends, that's a great time to bring that up and start talking about it. Because as you talk about it with your spiritual friends, you will have more things that come up within you, and you more insights that you will come. And when you get those insights, write them down. Create a list. Create an inventory. Later in this lesson, I'll tell you what to do with that list. But right now, just start creating the list. Later, we'll talk about strategies for dismantling obsessions. Right now, we're just going to gather lists of obsessions. What are the ulterior motives, the ulterior agendas that my false self imposes on me? All right, make yourself a note. That's enough for this week. We'll pick it up here next week. Spirit of God, may we be alerted during the weeks before us, during the days ahead of us, to what the unconscious powers are and what is the hold that they would have over us. And I pray that we would be a watchful community, a seeing community, an aware community. Be it so in us, in Jesus' name. Amen.